Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that has seen off two Tory Prime Ministers and will soon see off a third. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
Now, the original plan was not to record an episode this week and release a clip show instead and wait for the European election results and everything to blow over. And then, as so often happens, reality came and messed up our plans. Turns out there's going to be a leadership contest from a key party that we need to talk about. Yeah, it's true, Vince Cable standing down. But not only that, after we learnt about the many faces of Vince Cable are going to step down and it's going to be a Lib Dem contest in June, the Prime Minister's resigning too.
Wow. Everything just comes at you at once these days, doesn't it?
Everything has changed, Steve. Everything has changed. Leadership race. It's going to be Jo Swinson, isn't it?
Pretty much.
Okay. Should we move on to the Tories?
Yeah, let's do that.
Theresa May's resignation has been on the cards for some time, hasn't it? But the catalyst for her resigning on Friday was the uproar against the latest instalment in the Meaningful Vote franchise, Meaningful Vote 4. Why was that?
It's all just kind of the standard kind of kerfuffle. Theresa May is basically moving towards effectively trying to get something through Parliament at this point. The Meaningful Vote franchise was moving back towards indicative votes, I believe, again.
I think what May did was essentially in Cabinet try and consolidate all of the bits and bobs from different Meaningful Votes into one manageable Meaningful Vote. She was trying to get the withdrawal bill passed with things like the Lisa Nandy, Gareth Snell amendment on workers' rights, trying to have stuff on environmental protection. So in that sense, there's nothing new that's in there. It's a cut and paste from lots of different Word documents, if you like.
I was going to say, nothing says effective legislation than sticky taping bits and pieces together.
But the thing that really, it seems... the bunker at the moment, because there's a chance that Boris Johnson might become Prime Minister, the warning system in the bunker's gone to DEFCON 3... If it looks like it's going to be Dominic Raab, there'll just be one big whine that just carries on going. And if it's Marc Francois, I think we just stop transmitting.
That's how you know Marc Francois has become Prime Minister. It's the Not in a Champagne podcast will go off the air.
I don't think we should pledge that. That could be what tips him over the line. What really seems to have brought the Cabinet against May this time was the idea that May would legislate for another referendum. And she seems to, in her statement to the public announcing the withdrawal bill, has gone beyond what she said in Cabinet.
And again, I think this is just a classic case of May trying to do everything she can to try and keep herself in power, and she's just run out of the road. She's tried to say one thing to one group of people, another thing to another group of people, another thing to the public, and guess what? Eventually people have gotten fed up about it. And it was quite clear that basically the 1922 committee were going to change the rules and make it so that she could be challenged again. Although, can I just say that the way they were going to change the rules and the way that they were going to talk, release this information was the most ridiculous thing ever. They'd already voted. They put the results of the vote in a sealed envelope and then they were going to reveal it if Theresa May didn't resign or give a leaving date. It was like the most theatrical piece of Woolis I've ever come across.
Football fans may remember the Brendan Rodgers documentary when he was Liverpool manager, and he starts the season by putting some names in an envelope and he tells the squad, I've put the names of people from the squad who I think might let me down in an envelope, and I'm not going to show you who it is, but I'm just going to put them in this envelope. And that's meant to be some sort of motivating technique.
I don't understand how that's meant to help you at all.
No, neither did Liverpool. They didn't win the title that season.
That was a shock.
Andrea Leadsom resigned, signing her resignation letter in a turquoise gel pen.
Nothing says like official business like a turquoise gel pen. Are we sure it wasn't scented?
I think it could have been scented. I think if I had to sign a resignation letter, I would definitely use a fountain pen.
At the very least, like a biro.
But it does look like that gel pen was the straw that broke the camel's back. If I can mangle a couple of metaphors. Andrew Leadsom, the 36th cabinet minister to resign from Theresa May's government over the past almost 3 years. Now, I went to a House of Commons briefing note on ministerial resignations, and the first one they have is Joseph Chamberlain's resignation over tariff reform in 1903. Now, from 1903 for 36 ministers to resign, that took 29 years. So from 1903 to 1932, there were 36 cabinet resignations. After World War II, from 1945, there were 36 cabinet resignations. So it took 30 years for those 36. It's really interesting because you read through the reasons why these people have resigned. And in 1938, there was only one minister, Duff Cooper, who resigned over the Munich Agreement. In 1945, there was only one minister that resigned over the treatment of the Poles by the Yalta Agreement and Churchill essentially selling out Poland to Stalin. Only one minister resigned in both those cases. And we've had a good dozen or two dozen ministers resign over a customs union.
Well, depending on how you want to spin it, either cabinet ministers and members of the cabinet and members of the government in the past were much less principled and were happy to just go along to secure their ministerial cars, or the current crop of politicians who have been resigning left, right and centre have become an awful lot more idealistic to the point of potentially absurdity.
I'm not really sure I describe Esther McVeigh and Steve Baker as idealists necessarily. I wonder if it's more maybe cabinet collective responsibility was stronger then than it is now, in that you would have had lots of discussions in cabinet and cabinet would have come to an agreed view and you would have to own that view. Whereas it feels like we've moved to a much more presidential system of government in which ministers don't necessarily feel as consulted over decisions as they did in the past. And one of the things that's come, I mean, one of the biggest criticisms of May as Prime Minister was her secretive approach and the fact she didn't consult people. I wonder if that's an element of it too.
I mean, it might be an element of it, but I do think there is just more broadly a greater focus on people's kind of trying to match up their own individual kind of like politics and focus on their points of views and things like that. And I think Brexit is a kind of a classic example of that. And as a result, you're much more likely to get people to draw a line in the sand and say, on this issue, I will not put up with anything else. Another example of this, Johnny Mercer basically said, I'm not going to vote with the government anymore over the way it's handling effectively bringing up former soldiers on trial for allegations about their activities in Ireland in the past, despite the fact that they've been investigated multiple times and no wrongdoing has been found.
Of all the hills to die on, that feels like the worst hill to die on.
Former squaddy. I can get away from his perspective. But
Also, that's probably not the best metaphor to use, but we'll move on. I think it's also, it's not the Johnny Mercer and Adrian Leighton and all the other ministers who resigned, they've not resigned over the fact that we've had a huge increase in the number of homeless people.
Nope.
They're not resigning over the fact that we've just had a UN report that says the British government essentially brought back the workhouse and is almost getting rid of any safety net. They're not resigning over the fact that the Human Rights Watch are saying the government is not fulfilling its statutory duty to stop people getting hungry. They're not resigning over that. They're resigning over whether or not we have to be part of a customs union, when we have to be part of a customs union anyway because we've got a land border between us and the EU and we need border checks. It's just madness.
Yeah, well, as I say, broadly speaking, it boils down to these are their principles. These are the things that they are prepared to draw the lines in the sand again. And yes, quite frankly, it is absurd that they're choosing that this is the hill to die on. But hey, that's the politics of the right wing in Britain these days. Like they don't care about the fact that the UN is criticising us for bringing back effectively the poorhouses or anything like that, because as far as they're concerned, that's fine. This current situation, those people just need to pull themselves up by the bootstraps, totally ignoring the fact that this generation of right wingers who hold those sorts of views, they didn't pull themselves up with their bootstraps. They had a hell of a lot of help from the government. Governments in the forms of grants, in the forms of free university and all kinds of other bits and pieces, which that same generation has now removed from everybody else who's younger than them.
I wonder if it's also because you've got a situation where we talk about politics as being more of a career, which you'd think would be an argument not to resign your ministerial seat. But maybe it's partly, as you say, Europe is just one of those things that just turns a certain branch of conservative insane. I think it's also one of the reasons why Andrew Leadsom probably resigned was to steal a early march in the leadership race. And it feels like, certainly one of the reasons the cabinet turned against May with her withdrawal agreement this week is a lot of the cabinet did not want to vote for this withdrawal agreement in this form. And I think people like Sajid Javid, or the Saj, as we should know him, people like Jeremy Hunt, or the Hunt, as sadly he's not being called, I don't think they wanted to vote for this bill because they thought it would decimate their chances of a leadership run.
Almost certainly. Pretty much everything over the past 3 to 4 months, if not longer, in the Conservative Party and in the way that the significant players in the government have been acting, has been determined by the fact that there's been a shadow leadership election happening. We discussed it previously in one of the episodes a couple of weeks back now, when they realised something is actually going to hinder their chances at actually potentially getting into number 10 themselves, or people are actually finally prepared to kick May out, even though fundamentally they should have been doing this years ago. Sorry, should have been doing this 6 months ago.
So our latest news from the bunker is that the Boris Johnson alarm has abated slightly, given that Matt Hancock has now entered the race. So hopefully that'll be the last we hear of it for now. We do apologise for any inconvenience caused by Boris Johnson.
Is that going to be Britain's tagline when he becomes Prime Minister?
Yeah. Right, let's think about May's resignation. What strikes me is she's going to be remembered as, well, I think it's two things actually. One of them is that she's the Prime Minister that didn't deliver on Brexit after making it her mission to deliver on Brexit. I think the second thing is she was one of the longest serving Home Secretaries, especially when the New Labour seemed to have a succession of Home Secretaries brought down by scandal, and May was a very much an antidote to that. And one of the reasons she became Prime Minister was because she was seen as being a safe pair of hands at the Home Office, which traditionally had been a bit of
a hotbed for career ending.
Yeah. And actually, now that the Windrush stuff has come out, her time at the Home Office looks very, very different, given the scandal that's been on there, the deportations that are going on there, and still going on there. And so, in terms of her record as a Home Secretary, it's definitely a lower reputation than it would have been 3 years ago. And as a Prime Minister, I don't really see it getting much better than the nadir it's currently in. I mean, she tried to redeem herself, didn't she?
Yeah, she tried to redeem herself. She tried to talk about, like, shift the narrative of her Prime Ministership to, you know, the things she'd achieved on the home front, talking about, oh yeah, we've set up mental health as the core of long-term NHS funding. We've looked to redress the balances in terms of funding for support for domestic abuse victims. We're leading the way now on environmentalism with banning, you know, plastic straws and cotton buds and all of those sorts of things, which are all individually, I don't think you could really complain about any of them as policies, but they didn't really fix the problems that we actually are facing in those areas. They're broadly speaking, they're good policies, but they don't go far enough. And if your legacy is to be a load of stuff that Michael Gove did, and everyone knows Michael Gove did, and one small thing on domestic on support for domestic abuse victims, it's not much of a legacy to stand on.
I think one of the other things is that she talked about instituting an inquiry into Grenfell Tower and the disaster there. But I think, and this is, lots of people have mentioned this already, I think what she will be remembered chiefly is her lack of reaction to Grenfell Tower, and the fact that she saw members of the fire service but didn't, or the local officials but didn't see any of the victims. And I think she will be remembered for that and her lack of reaction to that. And just as Grenfell Tower became a bit of a metaphor for austerity Britain and the lack of funding, the lack of investment, the lack of care that was brought into these working class communities, her lack of reaction will be seen, again, as a bit of a metaphor for her uncaring nature, I think.
Yeah, I think pretty much, again, like one of the criticisms and kind of slogans and nicknames that's been given for her is the Maybot, because she just kind of carried on. She was cold. She was supposed to be calculating, although her calculations never seemed to really pay off or go anywhere. And she just lacked empathy, seemingly, for people. At least she came across as lacking empathy. I'll be honest, I don't think there's a single person, unless you actually are like a full-on psychopath as in a medical, actually, you know, defined psychopath who looked at Grenfell and didn't feel sympathy and didn't kind of go, this is a terrible tragedy. Yeah, I'm sure Theresa May did feel that. But the problem is she doesn't understand what needs to be done or how to get there or get away from that, because she's just focused on her own little world and doesn't have the understanding of other bits of Britain.
Well, so in blogs for the website a year or two ago, I think I compared Theresa May to Gordon Brown. And I think that comparison holds in that I think in both there's a very big difference between the persona they've got in private and the persona they've got in public. And I think Gordon Brown is someone who was always very scared of saying the first thing that came into his head and would always have to calculate and think about what the second thing was. I think the nadir of this was the Mumsnet Q&A when he was asked what his favourite biscuit was and didn't give a clear reaction, almost because his head was scrambled and couldn't think of a politically acceptable answer. And the impression I get with May is that in private, she can be very emotional. And I'm sure there's been talk of her welling up and being teary in private. And I'm sure that there was a lot of emotion for Grenfell in private, but it wasn't seen in public. And I think it's one of those things where we expect our prime ministers to do what people like David Cameron and Tony Blair could do very well, which is to emote publicly and be able to be a statesman and almost act as our, show our grief collectively. And I don't think May does that. She's very uncomfortable with doing that.
Absolutely. And it's not actually something that's very easy to do. And depending on kind of like your point of view about what makes a good leader and all of that sort of stuff, then really, maybe you don't want that out of someone who's prime minister. To a degree, you know, a certain degree of detachment in certain circumstances could be a positive. It really just depends on what it is you're looking at. But we are definitely shifting into, if not already shifted, into an era where you need to be able to connect with people in some capacity. And that's something just May's always struggled with, just because I don't know. No, I've never met her personally or anything like that, so I've got no idea what she's like in private.
If you do want to come on the podcast, though.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nothing else to do now.
Yeah. Well, after June 7th.
Yeah, get Trump on. That could be fun. We definitely have to break the new alcohol rule.
Yeah, definitely. May always came across as cold. She always came across as not understanding and both unsympathetic and unempathic as well. She just didn't seem to understand, and if she doesn't understand about the rest of the world, why should we care about her? And I think that's fundamentally one of her biggest qualities. We like to talk about charisma as kind of this kind of nebulous concept, but there's different sorts of charisma. And May's a solid public speaker. Like, she's not actually bad in that regard at all. And in other circumstances, you'd probably say she's quite charismatic, but not when it comes to connecting with people on that one-to-one level, which is what politics is all about.
I think it feels like it was part of a shyness, which again made the 2017 election campaign so problematic, because essentially they're trying to build a cult of personality around someone who, even if it may be unfair to say she's got no personality, but she's very, very unwilling to show that personality in private.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of those things where I always kind of tend to view a lot of prime ministers in terms of how their personalities are by kind of like how TV shows like Dead Ringers or Spitting Image would kind of portray them and parody them. It's like really easy to do Tony Blair. It's really actually quite easy with a bit of thought to do Gordon Brown or David Cameron or George Osborne and even like Nick Clegg. But Theresa May has got a lot of the John Major about her, and that she's just quite, her personality doesn't shine through in any aspect. There's nothing that stands out about her. And if you don't stand out in the age of social media as a person through your personality in some form, it doesn't really matter about anything else. You're not going to connect with people.
I think the private eye parody of Theresa May works best, which is as the headmistress of a failing academy school. The other thing, I suppose, is that she ended her speech talking about compromise and the value of compromise, which is not so. And Theresa May is not someone who was known for compromising. She was especially as Home Secretary on the immigration target, seen as someone who would dig in her heels and not compromise.
Yeah, I do wonder. The specific section that you're talking about is when she was talking... she was relaying advice that she'd received from Nicholas Winton, the gentleman who organised the kinder transport and taking children out of Germany during the war. And the advice that Winton gave her was, never forget that compromise is not a dirty word. Life depends on compromise. Now, you're right that when you look back at her career, broadly speaking, she's not one who not had a political career. You would say this is filled with compromise. But then there's a small part of me where I don't feel this is... I feel that this is her trying to say, yes, actually, in this one and this one particular area that we're dealing with currently, Brexit, we do need to compromise in some capacity. And I think this is her trying to give advice to the Tory party as a whole, that just trying to be pure and barreling ahead with a no-deal Brexit isn't necessarily going to be realistic.
But the reason the Tory party is barreling ahead with a no-deal Brexit is because Theresa May, for the best part of 18 months, repeatedly said that no deal was better than a bad deal.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is Theresa May's fault. What Theresa May did is treat Brexit not as a policy program, a policy problem to be solved, but as something that the Tories could use for electoral advantage.
Yeah.
That's why we get the Crush the Saboteurs, we get the Citizens of Nowhere, we don't get reaching out to the opposition. What she could have done is sideline the ERG very early on, work with the opposition, work with Labour, and get some sort of... Norway is a proper Brexit compromise, really. And we've been saying that for a couple of years. If you're going to compromise, which a 52-48 result suggests, that is your compromise. May didn't do that, egged on by Nick Timothy, who thought that, and probably her, as we've said before, her views on immigration, that somehow the Brexit result was about immigration and therefore we have to reduce immigration.
Mm-hmm.
That leads her to, without consulting any cabinet members, with no compromise, any sort at all, giving a speech in which she says we're going to leave the single market and the customs union. And all of the problems that we have on Brexit stem from that.
Yeah.
May's Brexit deal, the withdrawal bill we've got that is out at the moment, is not a compromise. It's like saying that the compromise between a meat burger and a veggie burger is a Twinkie. It doesn't work. It's not a compromise. It's rubbish. And the reason it's rubbish is because May made a fundamental strategic mistake right at the start of her premiership, and ever since then has been then having to play catch up.
Absolutely.
It doesn't work.
But I think so much of everything you talked about there in terms of the kind of like the red lines that she made, right down to sending in Article 50 when it was sent, when we didn't have any preparations in place for anything, was just down to what I've been saying for ages, which is that every decision she's made on Brexit, and probably for the most part of everything she's done in government, has been about trying to maintain her position and try and maintain her premiership. I could be being very optimistic, naive, whatever, however you want to call it. But to me, given how she reacted, how she was kind of looking at how she gave the speech, I feel that I do suspect that when she's talking about the compromise element, that's her kind of going, this is where I went wrong. I think there is a certain amount of self-reflection in there. And again, maybe I am being naive. Maybe I'm just trying to see the best in someone here. But for me, that's where I feel that little section on compromise is coming from. And so when she's saying it, she is saying it as a warning of like, hey, look what just happened to me. I didn't compromise and now I'm done.
She needs to be, I think, much more explicit on that. And I think also there's still a sense of she did start the fire. And she didn't start the fire, but she poured petrol.
Yeah.
She poured petrol on the fire and then is saying, well, actually, maybe we have to compromise with the fire and maybe we should put water on the fire. It's like, well, yeah, maybe you should have done. But obviously she doesn't quite beat Nick Timothy for lack of self-awareness.
No.
But maybe where I would maybe want to be a little bit more generous to May is that when she did have she could have gone full pelt no deal a month or two ago rather than try and extend Article 50. And when she was staring into the fire and staring into the abyss, she did plump for getting a Brexit deal over going for no deal. I think that reflects well on her.
Yeah.
But again, if she's going to try and send a message to her party, she could do with being a little bit more explicit. I suppose the flip side of that is anyone in her party going to listen to her now?
Arguably, Matt Hancock is. Matt Hancock's already started talking about we need one of the, started off his leadership campaign by criticising Theresa May. Kelsa Prue's shock horror. But what he's basically said is Theresa May was not honest about the trade-offs. Theresa May was not honest about the saying it's about if you want sovereignty, it means giving up trade. It's if you want this, you may have to give up that. Hancock's actually been quite seemingly out of the gate, relatively nuanced in terms of how we've used it. I mean, Hancock's not Hancock's a Brexiter, I believe. But either way, he is going out of his way to make that point early on. So I think Hancock, at least, you know, I'm sure he was planning to say this sort of stuff anyway, but there's a definite, the fact that he is saying it means he and his team view that there's at least a bit of an appetite for that kind of discussion. So
how irresponsible to torpedo his leadership ambition with such a message. We are going to have podcasts on the leadership election soon. We're going to have the first ever Not Enough Champagne leadership draft. I am very excited about this. I've been planning this for months. But it's already been a fantastic piece of political theatre. We've had lots of homely shots of leadership candidates in kitchens with wives. We've had James Brokenshire with about 408 ovens. When we run out of food, we can just go to James Brokenshire's house and he can bake us all the bread. And Liz Truss has also been very good value for money.
Well, Truss is always good value for money when it comes to like interviews and things like that, so that doesn't surprise me.
A really good mix of eye-catching libertarian policies and dodgy-looking Instagram shots with Russian ministers and quite spectacular trousers. And I realise that sounds terrible, that the one female leadership candidate I've mentioned, I've also mentioned what she wore, because all of the other... It's a balance. The male candidates were all basically wearing pastel shades or suits, but mainly pastel shades.
Yeah, because they have no personalities at all, and at least Truss is demonstrating hers in some capacity.
It's going to be fun, honestly. Right, we haven't mentioned the European elections, thank God.
More on that at some point in the near future when the results come out.
We're going to do a podcast next week in which we'll try and talk about the European election campaign. We, in the meantime, we have a website, which is notenoughchampagne.com. We have a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. Our Twitter handle is @nochampagnepod. I'm @paperbackwriter.
I'm @acousticradical.
Happy plotting, especially Boris Johnson.
Matt Hancock. Esther McVeigh.
Gavin.